For Indian nations and indigenous people, that I find the most important thing is relationship. We value relationship way beyond anything else. Relationship, to be close, to be next to the tree, to be next to the water, to be next to the earth.
Welcome to Sacred Land Speaks, where we explore the audio archives of the Sacred Land Film Project and revisit the interview clips we left on the cutting room floor over 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. Today we bring you part two of our 2011 interview with Onondaga faith keeper Orrin Lyons from our four-part series, Standing on Sacred Ground. In 2012, co-producer Jessica Abbey and I were invited to attend a three-day remembrance of Hopi elder Thomas Banyakya at the foot of Navajo Mountain in northern Arizona. A few days later, we set up our camera, a little too close to the highway as it turned out, with the dramatic red rock cliffs of Monument Valley as a backdrop. This was actually a violation of our protocol that an elder of Orrin's stature should speak to us in his traditional home territory, Iroquois Six Nations country, amidst the lakes of upstate New York. But Orrin is an international messenger. He calls himself a runner, who can speak anywhere. And we were there with common purpose, to honor Thomas Banyakya and his lifelong defense of sacred land. Orrin helped me understand how he and his Haudenosaunee people maintain right relationship to the earth, just as Thomas did, and the Hopi continue to do.
Yeah, well, how do you inform your people? How do you maintain this relationship? How do you polish it? How do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it shiny? How do you work with it? How do you enjoy that? Well, our people have done that through ceremonies. We do these ceremonies. I know our leaders were sitting last week at Onondaga setting the time for the strawberry ceremony, which will probably be this coming weekend, if not yesterday. I don't know. They could have moved it that fast, which means that while we were on our mission down here, we missed our ceremony back home. And that's a sacrifice not to be there. But what we do is we have developed these very elaborate thanksgivings that requires a community to do that. And it requires everybody to be part of it, and it's a lot of work. Now, this one for the strawberry, that's a ceremony for the leaders of the fruit, strawberry. And so when we're having that ceremony, we're talking about all the fruits of the world, and we're talking about everything that we know and things that we don't know, but we know they're out there. We know there's a lot of things that we don't know, but it's there. So we think about that. We add them all in as much as we can, and we have a big Thanksgiving. And how do we do that? We make songs, and we make dances, and we make speeches. This goes on, and we make food, and we participate as a community, and it requires everybody to work, to take part in our bigger ceremonies. They might say the six-day ones, that's 6 days of work, 6 days of somebody getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and beginning to make the corn soup so that when you start in the morning, that soup is there ready, because you can't have the ceremony without the soup. So somebody's working at 6 hours to make corn soup. Somebody's doing that, so you'll have it for the ceremony. Somebody volunteers for that. I'll do that. So what is your part? Our part is to show up to the ceremony and take part and be there. I remember one of my friends one time, we were in passing, just passing down a road, close friend. I said, you're going to go to the meeting tomorrow. I said, well, you're going to be a speaker. And he said, I'm going, he says, I'm not speaking, I'm just going to be there and make the crowd bigger. There's a lot in what he said. People don't understand how these simple things mean so much. It's just basic, simple participation. Be there. A leader is not a leader if he's not there leading. So what's your first duty as a leader is to be there so people see you. They take heart and they see you. Gives them strength. You draw them together. That's your strength. Strength is in community. Strength is in all these trees, and you see all these roots are together. They're holding together underneath here. They're working together. It's a community that you're looking at right here. It's a big community. Our friend that beetle who's been walking around here listening, he's listening. He's glad to hear a talk, at least somebody's talking on behalf. Just the fact that you bring your presence there and you join in with the others, keep a good mind. And that's where our instruction has always been. Power of the good mind is to be unified. Unity their strength.
I love how whatever his surroundings, Oren could find a lesson to share, learning from the beetle that landed on his lap throughout our interview, or from the trees that were growing all around us.
It's the idea of community, which is fundamentally important, the importance of community, and to understand what community is. The earth is all community. So when you go into a forest and you cut trees, and especially if you're going to clear cut trees, you destroy a whole community in there. A medicine or a plant grows by a certain bush, and a certain bush will grow by a certain tree, and a certain tree will grow by certain other trees. And so each is taking part in the process of being together as a community, and they require each other to have that community of being. And so when you disturb that, you disturb a community, which is functioning very well in doing what it's supposed to be doing. And so when you come in, you can imagine to cut down all the trees and just destroy that whole community of life, which may be some very important medicine there, may be something very special at that particular place, has gone. And just gone for what? And then you come to the question, what's most important? Is that community most important? Or is the money that was going to be made from the sale of those logs and those trees more important? So it's a matter of evaluation and understanding what's important to you. So for Indian nations and indigenous people that I find, the most important thing is relationship. We value relationship way beyond anything else, way beyond what you can have relationship, to be close, to be next to the tree, to be next to the water, to be next to the earth. That relationship's really good. It's really rich. And amongst ourselves, relationship between people. You know, among the Haudenosaunee, among our people, we have greetings, and you'll hear it from especially the men, they have personal greetings. Just their greeting, just them two people, their own special greeting. And you'll hear it all the time. And it's funny sometimes. And you always know that whatever it was that they're talking about, it was very special. And so they greet each other to remind each other of that time and that moment. And I was a little boy, and we were having a big feast at the longhouse, and boy, food was around, and it's everywhere, and I was looking at this pie that was sitting on a table. I was just waiting to get at that pie, and I was about at that level where my eyes were about even with the table, you know, and I'm watching that pie, and I'm watching the lady, finally she cuts a piece of pie and puts it in a plate, and I was standing there, and I reached for the pie, and all of a sudden, these two big hands came for the same plate, you know, and I pulled my hands back, you know, right away. I said, oh, I didn't realize there was this man behind me that she was giving the pie to, and I thought it was for me. And I hear him laugh, you know, and he says, no, take that pie, I'll get another one. Well, I was embarrassed, you know, took my pie over in the corner, and I was sitting there, and Geez. That was really embarrassing. So while I was sitting there, he comes by and he says to me, "How's my pie?" And I said, "Good pie." He laughed. For the rest of our life, that's how he greeted me. "How's my pie?" See, that's relationship. Where are you going to get that? How important is that? That's what we value. Way beyond anything. So when we relate here, it's hard for people to understand that. They have different values.
As a former professor of American Studies, Orrin often reminds audiences that back in the 1700s, the leaders of the Confederacy of Native Nations, of which the Onondaga are a member, advised America's founding fathers and shared the Six Nations' principles of government, valuable lessons that were later enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. And the Haudenosaunee leaders also shared the story of the peacemaker.
And the Constitution was made, we had a lot to do with that. Six Nations had a lot to do with that Constitution, the fundamental processes of unity and peace, collective, to work together. We instructed your leaders on that many years. But the peacemaker said, put your minds together, one heart, one mind, one spirit, to be unified. When he illustrated that to us, our people, he took an arrow and he snapped the arrow. He said, this is a nation. And he snapped the arrow. And then he took the five arrows representing the Mohawks and the Oneidas and the Onondagas, the Cayugas and the Senecas, were the nations there. And he said, these arrows represent you. And he took the sinew of the deer and he wound that sinew around that arrows. And he said, here's your strength. Here's your unity. And 1,000 years later, maybe, in Albany, New York, 1775, the speakers for the colony said, we heard your story about the arrows, and we are binding ourselves together, using that very simple. That was your colonies that said to us, we're taking your advice. We're now going to become a union like you. The 13 arrows, they said, we're binding ourselves to be united like you, and we're planting a fire here. When they came to us, they said, you talk about community, yes, we do. And your leaders did too early on. They agreed with that. They said, we're going to be like you. And so they made the Continental Congress, and when they made the Continental Congress, they made a flag. And you remember the first flag they made? What was that on the flag? It was a pine tree. It was our symbol. They put the tree on there. That's how close we're related to them. We helped instruct in the Constitution, Six Nations did, fundamental principles. And you were following that, pretty much. I would say the closest that you ever came to being like a Native Nation was Continental Congress. That's when you called yourself the 13 fires, as we call ourselves the six fires. When you used our words and used our symbols, you were very close then. And then when you made the Constitution itself, in the process of making the Constitution, started to revert back to Europe. And you took things out of that Constitution that should have been in there. For instance, your partner, the women, they were left out entirely. In fact, they had to fight their way back in, what, 1924? That's amazing when you call yourself a democracy. Anyway, at that time, in making the Constitution, you're reverting back to enclosure and the land rights. That's where you were moving, consolidating. And thinking again like Europeans who came over in the beginning. It was reverting. And so what you realized after that was what you had to take out had to be go back in again. So that's when you made a Bill of Rights to put things back in that you took out. and a Bill of Rights is what you called it. And our instruction has always been about responsibility. So it should have been a Bill of Responsibility. If it was a Bill of Responsibility, I think we'd be in better shape today than a Bill of Rights. So we have to think about that. And when the peacemaker said, 7 generations, that's an instruction of accountability and responsibility. 7 generations, don't think about yourself. So in our nation today, we're the last standing nation in North America that's still in charge of land, last traditional outfit. There's no others. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is in every other Indian nation in the country except ours. And they've invaded also into the Senecas and the Mohawks as well. Onondagas, no. Tuscarora, no. Tonawanda Senecas, no. We're still traditional people operating under those instructions. And we have chiefs with the Mohawks, Senecas as well, Oneidas. So the principles stand. Peace, equity, power of the good minds. And that's where we are again. That's where we stand. And it's doable. It's always doable. But you have to have instructions and you have to have the values behind that, which is community. It's community.
Orrin was very specific and very clear about how we can all still learn from his people.
We're at this time, and leaders have to take a long perspective. You've got to take that 7-generation perspective. Because if you take care of the future 7 generations from now, you yourself will have peace. That's how it's going to be. If you're protecting the future, then you're protecting yourself now. And you benefit immediately by that. And so the ideas of profit and loss, that has to be adjusted and changed. Business as usual is over. It's over. You can't do what you've been doing. Just can't. It's over. Unless you change, you're just going to drive into the ground. It's not competition, it's cooperation. You're going to have to cooperate now. You can't sit down and compete. You're going to cooperate. And then you're going to have to fight for the commons, for the common good. Protect the land, because when you cut down all these trees in a rainforest and wherever you're going, you may be destroying the very medicine that you're going to need for survival. You don't know. You know just a very little of what's in there. But it's more important to cut a tree down and put money in your pocket than it is to protect the future. And until you change your direction of thinking and you start to worry about the commons and a common good in the future, we might have a chance. We might have a chance. It's really up to us. So your teachers are going to be indigenous people. Because they have the best, they've kept on to it. I mentioned yesterday, they said, well, if the worst happens and it all comes to the final crisis, I said, there will be survivors. And who will be surviving? The survivors will be the poorest people because they know how. They got practice in how to survive. They know how to survive on almost nothing. And who's going to go first? Going to be the wealthiest people, because they have no idea how to survive. They're living in complete dependence on everything. They couldn't take care of themselves if they had to.
Orrin told a few powerful stories to illustrate his point.
I had a friend from Sweden, and he had very bad sickness, and he understood that there was a native people in Amazon that knew how to fix that. Yeah, I'm going down there, he said. I'm going to see if I can get fixed up. And he went. He left, went down there. He was a woodsman, a good one. He knew how to survive up in Sweden. He went down there. And they said, well, the people you're looking for, they live way in over there. And so we don't get along too good with them, but we know where they are and we know what they do. We'll help you get there. And he said the help they gave him was a 12-year-old boy. And he said they went through the forest. They went through the rainforest. He said, I couldn't survive there. He said, this boy never talked to me, never said a word. He would make a fire out of, I don't know where he made the fire. He would find something to eat. I don't know where he found that. And the next day we'd be on, and we walked our way. And finally, he said, we came to the river. On the other side was the village, and the boy simply motioned with his chin, turned around and walked away. He said, I was a child in that woods. He said, that 12-year-old boy knew how to survive out of everything. I was amazed. I learned a lesson. And that's what indigenous people know. It's nature, nothing unusual to be 12 years old and know how to survive. But you turn around now and you just look at ourselves and how ill-equipped we are to survive. We're in trouble. We're in trouble by our own hand. And we're soft-shell creatures, so we're subject to all kinds of stuff. But we're awful smart, and we're awful brilliant, and we have an intellect. And we better start using it for common good, because that's where we have to change. Now myself, I'm simply a runner. I've been running for the nation, I've been running for the chiefs, I've been running for the people. I'm not intelligent. I'm intelligent enough to know what I'm talking about. But I don't know a lot. But I know a lot of people who do know a lot. And those kinds of people we have to protect, and we have to learn from them. And they're the very people who are suffering the most right now. So our future is in our hands, and we're able to handle it, and we can. We can if we work together. It's as simple as that. Some 7 billion people here looking at a very dire situation. If you have children and grandchildren, you have tremendous responsibility. And it's not only the children, but it's the deer that run. It's the animals here. You know, we had our friend the beetle here. He was listening. He was listening. He was hanging around here. Hear what we're doing. And they asked me, how do you instruct people to know what you're talking about? And I said, it's simple. Simple instruction. I said, you can't negotiate with a beetle, as he's operating under a different law. He's operating under the law that we are, but we don't understand that. You can't negotiate with a beetle. That's nature. You can't negotiate with nature. There's no bailout. You are what you are, and so here we are. So collectively, as a human species, we have a responsibility to look out for ourselves. And we can only do that by listening to what the peacemaker said, equity, justice for everybody. When you begin doing that, then you begin real survival. But if you don't do that, I'm a victim of your own hand. Nobody to blame but ourselves. So it's all in the offing. It's not settled yet. But we sure are pushing it.
As Oren tells it, the different values held by Christians on the one hand and America's First People on the other posed a grave challenge from first contact until today.
Religion has been our biggest problem, you know. It was the Pope who made that statement in 1493, if there are no Christian nations in this new land that you have discovered, I declare those lands to be empty, open for colonization by Christian nations, very explicit. Further, if there are people there and they are not Christians, they do not have a right of title to land. Disenfranchised the whole Western Hemisphere with one statement. We had no idea he said that. We had no idea. And it prevails today. Cheryl versus Oneida Indian Nation, 2005, First notation, doctrine of discovery. First notation. That's 1493. Doctrine of discovery. It's still calling us non-Christians, non-title. So, what has to change, obviously, is that kind of understanding. So Christianity has been a problem. Reading the early history of the hegemony of the Roman Empire and how they took over everywhere. They were everywhere, Africa included. And the most powerful state was the Vatican in those days. And this was supposed to be Christian law. Going back to the origins of Christian, and which was the leadership of Jesus, from what I've ever read, he's never said anything about capital. And as a matter of fact, what I remember is he threw some people out of the temple for selling in the temple. His instruction was, don't do that. That's what I remember. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't, you know, I'm not a student of the Bible either, but those kinds of things are pretty common usage. And then they try to kill him. In fact, they did, I guess. And that was killing a teacher, because you don't want to hear what they're saying. And that's the nature, I guess, that we're always instructed against, and why the peacemaker said to us, you know, put aside your weapons of war. Cast your weapons of war into this hole, and I'll give you the plant, you know, the tobacco plant. That's your strength. I mean, the teachers have always been killed. One of the greatest teachers of peace is Gandhi. He was killed. Another great teacher in his own way, very well, John Lennon. He was killed. Great black leader. He was killed. They don't want to hear it, do they? They don't want to hear it. They don't want to be disciplined. They don't want to be instructed. And that's always been the battle. We were told long ago that you have a spiritual center. In the center of us is a spiritual center. We stay balanced. Stay in the balance. Don't get too far over here. Don't get too far over here. Try to stay there in the middle. And we were told that on any given day, because of that balance, we can be the worst enemy of creation there ever was. On any given day. And some days we are. Some days we just are. We don't have to stay there. We have to combine that balance. And that's our instruction. Stay in the center. Stay in the balance. You need this, you need that. Stay in the middle. So that spiritual center is what we're always our guide and what we're always looking for. And it's always a challenge because we have options. We can do this or we can do that. On a personal basis, we probably go through it 10 times a day, at the least, every day.
Just as Oren uses his people's stories to teach, he also finds meaning in settler colonial stories. And he interprets those stories from a unique perspective, including a famous American tale written in 1900.
Everybody just loves The Wizard of Oz. But the man who wrote that just lived 20 miles away from Onondaga. He didn't like Indians. He called us pets of the government. And he wrote The Wizard of Oz. And that was a story that was written for somebody who was running for president. That's what that whole thing is about, and all the symbolism in it. There were symbols. The farmer, the scarecrow represented a farmer, and have no brains. And that's what they're saying at the time. Farmer doesn't have brains enough to take care of himself. Well, where do we go? We go to Oz, he knows. Well, where's Oz? Well, follow the yellow brick road. What's the yellow brick? Gold. onto the Yellow Brick Road. That was a big discussion back there. Shall we have the gold standard or shall we go, you know, with the greenbacks? The Emerald City of Oz. Well, it wasn't emerald. You had to have green glasses. When you got to Oz, you put on green glasses. Then the city was green. They're talking about paper, and they're talking about gold standard. It was an interesting story, and when you start reading it. And what about the woodsman? They found him out there, the tin man, he was laying all over, he had an axe. That's what he was. He was labor, no heart. He needed a heart, remember? And the cowardly lion, he needed courage. And that was going to be the president, who was saying, no, you don't have to have courage is there. That's the style of politics in those times. There was no television, there was no radio. They used stories. And so the fiercest of them all was the Wicked Witch of the West. And who was that? And that's your key. And who was helping the Wicked Witch of the West? Flying monkeys, and who were they? Well, I'll answer. The Wicked Witch of the West was nature, subdued by water, if you remember. And what they wanted to do was dig a canal all the way to Kansas. And that's why they were in Kansas. A story about Kansas. All of that, all symbolic. And who were the flying monkeys? Who were the pets of the government? Indians. And turned out that they were friendly at the end. And so Dorothy, who represented the American people, said, come with me and come back. And they said, no, we can't go past the river, which was the Mississippi. And they had shipped all the Indians on the other side to Mississippi. That's your Wizard of Oz. So who was the enemy? Mother Nature. And until you change your enemy and realize that's not your enemy, that's your mother, might have a chance. Just might.
Even though he outlined some dire problems and difficult challenges, Orrin also offered a path forward for those who want to change things.
In all my travels around the world, and many of the people I've met, I've met many, many friends, very sincere people, good friends. Some of the most honest people I've ever met is in New York City, when I worked in New York City for 10 years. Guy from Brooklyn, could bet your life on him. Honest, straightforward. They're everywhere. I mean, people have a common good about them. And that's what I find. And everywhere in the world, we're not very far apart, actually. People are people. And we have fundamental values that are pretty much the same, starting with the family. It's the manipulation of governments and corporations that have changed all that. But generally speaking, people are very, very close, actually. We're family, you know. We can change blood. We have a type B, type A. We all have the same blood, whether you're black or white or yellow or red or whatever. Which means you're the same. You're a brother and sister, family. And so our thinking and our structures and our values, fairly much the same. I think where we really went off on a tangent was when we gave away those safeguards that prevent us from keeping the balance within ourselves. When we allowed, as was said in some movie, greed is good. When you allow that idea to germinate and flower, that's where our problem all began. But history is very similar. Nations of fighting and war, terrible wars of the Romans and the Roman empires, or they would bring back heads of people or the testicles of men in big pile. This was a style of life. When I visited Europe, everywhere I went, there was a castle. In the castle, there were armaments on the wall. I looked at those armaments, battle armor. I looked at shields and big creases in them. I looked at swords and chips and axes. They were well-used tools of war, and they were everywhere. And when you go and visit these places, Switzerland, big pictures on the wall of great wars. That was a nature that you allowed to, what you try to control and keep in control, when you give it access and you give it a righteousness, then you lose, you know, the humanity. So what the peacemaker said was peace. Peace. Fight for it. Peace is not passive. Peace is tremendous work because it's kind of a light. The oppressiveness of something dark and powerful. You lose, you can't stand still, you have to push against it. Peace requires constant work. You can just get beat by the oppressiveness of the dark side of us. It's just easy to sleep in the morning rather than get up. Rather than get up with the sun. It takes effort to do that. It takes training. But if you get up with the sun, you got a whole day. If you sleep till noon, you've lost it. But you can. People do. And that's it every day.
Referring to the meeting where we had just honored the life of Hopi elder Thomas Binyakya, who was a member of the Coyote Clan, Oren pointed out that people need allies, need community, need to gather together to do the hard work of healing ourselves and protecting the earth.
It's always a renewal, a spiritual renewal when we meet together. We gain a lot from just seeing that our brother is still alive and that the women are holding up good, and it's a family. We have a big family. Like, I'm a wolf, that's my clan. And down here they have a coyote clan. That's my clan because they're related. So our relationship pops right over national boundaries, if you would want to look at it that way. So a wolf is a wolf is a wolf. And of course, my brother that runs in the woods, I mean, he's my family. I mean, that was no small thing to take on that responsibility of family. So as I say, you know, when you look at all the clans that the people have here, the Wind Clan, Water Clan, it's just great to hear how many clans they have. But that's all relationship. It's relationship with nature to make sure we pull ourselves close together. And all our ceremonies are relationship. And like I say, they hear us, they understand it. We speak the same language. And you could do that too. You try hard enough, you could do that. But it takes to be true. They know the difference. In the snake dance, when they have a snake dance, those guys start working in January to dance in August. They have to start cleansing. So they're going through purification all those times. And then when they come down to the kiva and they dumped all those snakes that they picked up from all the four directions, and they're all over the floor. Some are real poisonous snakes, coral snakes, rattlesnakes, vipers. They're all there. They're family. And they dance, and they're down there for, I think, 6 days singing, working with them, bringing rain. Bring in rain. That's what they're doing. They're working together to bring rain. That's what that snake dance is rain dance. They need it here. So they work collectively. And finally, on the last day, they will come up to the plaza and they will dance for the people. But they've been down there all this time. So who will dance for the people? And that's the one that can pick that snake up. Because now they've been down there for 6 days, now they're going up. So now they're going to put the snakes in a bag and take them upstairs, and they're going to put them in a plaza and dance with them. And if you're not pure enough, if you haven't purified yourself enough, a snake won't let you pick him up. So there are people down there that are not up there and dancing because they didn't work hard. So the ones that are up there, they're the ones that a snake agrees. Agrees, I trust you. So that's the relationship. So now you bring the rain. So when people come to this snake dance, you know, they come with umbrellas. They know it's going to rain. And you can see it on a clear sky like this. When they start, a little puff here and a little puff there, a little puff there, and the convergence. And by the time they're getting come up here, there's lightning flying. They bring rain. And we all have those kind of dances, and we all have those kind of relationship. So it's a working relationship with everything for the common good, always for the common good. I guess that's what we gain when we come together, because we don't have to exchange a lot. You know, we just renew our spiritual relationship. So when we did the traditional circle of Indian elders and youth, that was to remind people that you can keep your language. You can't speak to them in English. Have your own language and so forth. So it is a very powerful renewal for us, spiritual renewal. We try our best to stay away from politics. Try not to get into politics. Just let's do our pipes, let's do our ceremonies, let's renew ourselves spiritual. And then we get a good breath and then we're gone again for the year. And if we're lucky, then we travel and we meet each other all over the place. But the young man, I don't know how young he is, that was in our circle yesterday from Peru, he was very, very happy there. He didn't have to understand his language, but we're all very common. He shared with us quite a bit. He was going to have big stories when he goes home. But they're like that all over. We recognize each other immediately. I don't care where. We know. It's a spiritual experience, I guess, that is good for everybody.
When I interviewed Oren, we had just spent 3 days in ceremony, led by a new generation. Oren said he was encouraged by the way the young practitioners handled themselves, and he also helped me understand the larger significance of ceremony.
I think that the peace that we experience with all of this is worth all that effort. I mean, we have an amazing ability to get the best out of whatever's there. We always try to see the best, and just seeing these people and knowing that they're still there, you know, it's a good renewal. So we meet like that, and we know that all these ceremonies, there's a lot of ceremonies going on all around the world, and they're going on all the time, and they're pretty much the same, pretty much the same. So this is our work at this particular time in the whole creation, in the spectrum of life. This is where we're at, this is where you're at, this is where these two men are at here, who's traveling all over and trying to add to the good of it, you know. And that's all you can do, and I think that's the best you can do, and I think it's always by conduct that you lead. That's how you lead. People see what you do, and that's what they do. Not what you say, it's what you do. Your kids learn that right off the bat. And people are all the same. They watch what you do. So you lead by experience, and you lead by example. Try to do your best. And when, as long as you're doing that, the people will help you. They're very tolerant. They let you do a lot of things that they know in the end it's worth it all. So as long as you stay true to the mission of the earth and the people, they'll support you. And the minute you don't, they won't. So always get the best out of the day. That's my philosophy. One day at a time. It's a good day so far.
That was a good day for me as well. In 2016, I got to share another good day with Oren at the State University of New York in Syracuse. Donald Trump had just been elected president. I was on my way to the showdown at Standing Rock, and the Potawatomi biologist and writer, Professor Robin Kimmerer, hosted a screening of Standing on Sacred Ground. Oren and I spoke after the film, and he had some encouraging words on how we could face an uncertain future under the presidency of Donald Trump.
I think that this country needed to wake up and probably needed a shock like this to wake itself up to understand how far away they have drifted. The number one rule outside of, for indigenous people, outside of respect, is to share. You gotta share, gotta work together. That's the basic rule. Once you do that, then you have a community. And you also have to understand, you know, your relationship to the earth. You really have to understand the power and the authority. Nature. Nature's the boss, always been the boss. You have to submit the arrogance of humanity to the reality. Because if you don't, you just flat out lose, that's all. It's not complex, it's just hard. But the main thing is you don't quit. I mean, we wouldn't have been here a long time ago if our folks quit. We wouldn't be here. Talk about seven generations, that's what we talk about. Seven generations ago, there were leaders that saw to it that we were able to be sitting right here, right now. You gotta respect that. Gotta understand that. Those are values, long-term values, seven generations. That means you don't worry about yourself and you don't worry about what's gonna happen to you. You worry about what's gonna happen to your children. You don't worry about what's gonna happen to the future. That's what you worry about. That's being adult. That's being grown up. What grown up people are supposed to do if you want to survive. You know?
I will forever be grateful to Oren Lyons for this guidance, to remember that nature is the boss, and to never stop building community for the common good, with the next seven generations always in mind. Tune into the next episode of Sacred Land Speaks for my interview with the late Barry Lopez, the award-winning author who, along with Oren Lyons and Winona LaDuc, was one of the big thinkers in our Standing on Sacred Ground series. Barry was a good friend for decades, as we were both outsiders trying to be good allies to Indigenous communities and messengers working to communicate alternative values to our industrial society. If you like what you've heard, please rate and subscribe to Sacred Land Speaks on your favorite podcast app. You can also visit sacredland.org to learn more about our films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. This episode was produced and written by Callie Shanafelt-Wong and Toby McLeod. Our film interview with Oren was recorded by Andy Black and Dave Wendlinger, along with co-producer Jessica Abbey. Our theme music was composed and performed by Stefan Smith and Charles Johnson. Sacred Land Speaks is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in the Lejeune Ohlone Territory of Hootchewin, otherwise known as Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.